Good evening. What a wonderful audience. Thank you. Thank you for being here and joining us for a wonderful evening. It is with great pleasure that I welcome you to the 21st season of the Leon Panetta Lecture Series, back in our original home. We're back here at the Monterey Conference Center, and we're happy to return and want to thank the city of Monterey for hosting us once more. We're also very grateful to the warm welcome that we received from the city of Carmel and the Sunset Center during our 2 years there. We really appreciated their hospitality. Most of all, we thank our audience, you, our audience, for being willing to travel with us between these locations. This program would not be possible without the support of our partners and each one of you. This season, we're discussing the American dream, and we'll ask the question, is the American dream alive and well in 2018? This topic, of course, is of personal importance to Leon and me. We come from immigrant families who left their homeland in pursuit of the American dream. Leon and I were the beneficiaries of their courage and their tenacity and their basic desire to give their children a better life. I remember when Leon was named chief of staff for the Clinton administration, he remarked he couldn't believe that he, the son of Italian immigrants, stood in the Oval Office at the White House as an advisor to the President of the United States. Leon and I also work to give the American dream to our children, and it's what we hope to inspire in all of the students who participate in the different courses and programs that we sponsor at the Panetta Institute. However, we worry that this dream is becoming more and more out of reach for many Americans. This is particularly true in respect to our economy. The American dream has always been closely tied to economic opportunity and the idea that through hard work, Americans would be able to provide a good life for their families. However, the economy is changing, and there are concerns about access to good jobs, about economic stability, about trade, wage growth, and more. These concerns come at a time when a new president is challenging long-held ideas about trade and immigration. And his tax reform represents the largest overhaul to the tax code in 30 years. What will be the impact of these changes? How can we create economic growth and protect against inflation? Will the growing debt bring about increases in interest rates? Will new technologies help or hurt young workers to achieve the American dream? What is the impact of immigration on our economy? Tonight, Leon will pose these questions to two former United States senators who are well-versed in the complex issues that make up economic policy. Our first guest is a respected bipartisan leader and an impassioned expert on national security, on commerce, and job creation. A Republican, she served as New Hampshire's first female attorney general from 2004 to 2009. Elected to the Senate in 2010, she chaired the Armed Services Subcommittee on Readiness and the Commerce Subcommittee on Aviation Operations. She fought for budget certainty and opposed defense sequestration and championed policies to encourage private sector innovation and job creation, including the passage of the Revitalize American Manufacturing and Innovation Act. an advocate for tax reform. She helped pass proposals to reduce and suspend business taxes and supported efforts to rein in federal regulations that discourage investment and innovation. She worked to strengthen transportation infrastructure. She worked also to boost small business exports and lead the effort to extend the Export-Import Bank, allowing American businesses to compete in a global economy. She earned her BA from Pennsylvania State University and her JD from Villanova University School of Law. So please welcome Senator Kelly Ayotte.
Thank you so much.
Our second guest has been a key participant in nearly every major policy debate over the past three decades. After representing Connecticut in the United States Congress for 36 years, he has become one of the country's most widely respected legislators. He authored or co-authored major legislation in the areas of education, health, financial services, foreign policy, and election reform. In his final term in the Senate, he was the principal author of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act that was crafted in 2010 during the wake of one of the worst economic downturns in history. A leader in the fight for both financial regulatory reform and health care, he served as a senior member of the Foreign Relations Committee. He also played a decisive role in the writing and passage of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. He's well known for bringing much needed attention to children's and education issues. He wrote the Family and Medical Leave Act, which has provided more than 100 million Americans with job protective leave for health and caregiving needs. He received his BA from Providence College and his JD from the University of Louisville. Please welcome back Senator Chris Dodd. Yeah. Now, moderating the discussion is the man who created this lecture series 20 years ago. From his service as chairman of the House Budget Committee to his time as director of the Office of Management and Budget, and his experience negotiating the defense budget as Secretary of Defense, the economy is a subject he knows very well. So please welcome Secretary Leon Panetta.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this, which it's our 21st season of the Panetta Lecture Series, and it's good to be back in Monterey here at the Conference Center again. Tonight, we talk about the theme, Is the American Dream Alive and Well? This country was based on the promise of giving our children a better life, and even in our preamble of the Constitution, it talks about passing on the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. As Sylvia mentioned, as the son of Italian immigrants, I used to ask my dad, why did he come to this country? Because he traveled all of that distance to a strange land. Why did he leave the comfort of home, friends, even though he came from a poor area of Italy? And my father always said that the reason was because my mother and he believed they could give their children a better life in this country, which is the American dream. Fortunately, I've had the opportunity to live the American dream. And the question tonight is whether or not future generations in this country will have the same opportunity to be able to live the American dream. There are a lot of challenges today, challenges related to the changing jobs in our society. We're living in a period that Chris has mentioned is probably the most transformative since the Industrial Revolution. The creation of new jobs in technology, but jobs that are taking other jobs away from people. We're losing, as a result of unmanned vehicles, huge numbers of jobs, truck drivers, Uber drivers. We're losing jobs in the manufacturing area because of robotics. And so the question is, where are the jobs going to come from for our kids? What about the education system? Is it going to provide the opportunities, the skills that these kids are going to need as we develop in the 21st century? What about the growing debt in this country and the fact that they're going to inherit this huge debt? How will that impact on their ability to have a future? The whole issue of strength of our economy, inflation, immigration. This country has always opened its doors to those who have come here to be able to enjoy the American dream. Will that continue in the future? So there's a large number of issues that impact on the issue of the American dream. And I'll have the opportunity to talk with two very distinguished former senators from Connecticut and from New Hampshire, people that I've had the opportunity to work with in one capacity or another. But first, before I talk about economic issues, I have to address an issue that's in the news today, which relates to life and whether or not our children will be able to have a life that can experience the American dream. 17 young people in a school in Florida lost their lives as a result of a mass shooting. And the whole issue that is being debated in this country is whether or not we are going to take any steps to try to deal with that, whether in terms of access to weapons or whether in terms of providing the kind of mental care that ought to be provided to people. There are a number of steps that have been talked about. But the problem, as we all know, is that ultimately the politics of this issue has become so difficult that usually nothing gets done. This whole issue of bump stocks is a good example. When the whole bump stock issue came up as a result of the Las Vegas shooting, everyone agreed that we ought to get rid of bump stocks. It was the president, Republicans, Democrats, NRA said we ought to control it. Nothing happened. And so the question I want to ask both of you is, you know, as members of the Senate, having experienced the politics of this very difficult issue in the Senate, is it your sense, particularly as a result of these young people coming out and trying to push for some kind of change, will it in fact happen? Will we get the President and Congress, Republicans and Democrats, to enact legislation in this area, or is it likely that nothing will happen? Kelly?
Well, first of all, I just want to say how honored I am here to be here tonight at the Panetta Institute with Leon and Sylvia and just your incredible service to our nation. Also, earlier we had a session with students and the way that this institute engages students and the phenomenal questions that they asked, I'm just so impressed because they're the future leaders of this country. And as Secretary Panetta said, this horrible tragedy that has occurred in Florida, the students that have stood up really under just imagine having gone through what they've gone through and to have the courage to stand up with their convictions. Even if you don't fully agree with everything they're advocating for, you have to admire their strength and their advocacy. And really, I think they are making a difference And there will be some kind of movement in the Congress on this issue. A couple of areas where I see, I think, some agreement and some opportunities for some bipartisanship are, I mean, the bump stocks is obvious. That's not going to solve what happened, unfortunately, in Florida. But issues like making sure that people who are dangerously mentally ill do not have access to firearms, or even the president had suggested, I believe, today that there be a delay period, giving law enforcement the tools and the opportunity, if someone was struggling with mental illness, to be able to deny them access to a firearm. And in addition to that, strengthening our enforcement of the law, because I think one of the things that's been troubling is also just the number of contacts that law enforcement had potentially with the individual who committed this horrible acts. And whether it's more resources we need, more tools that law enforcement needs, we better give them what they need and make sure that they're trained and that they're able to intervene when it's a situation where the warning signs are there. But I will say this time, I believe that there will be some kind of action in the Congress, and those students, really, their voices are being heard, and you have to be impressed with their advocacy and the difference that they can make. And I think that's a message to the young people in this country, too, of that we obviously don't want anyone to suffer the way they have, but that people speaking up can make a difference, and the Congress will hear what they have to say, especially when they come together around such important issues.
Chris?
Well, first of all, thank you, Leon and Sylvia, wherever Sylvia went. This is the second time they've invited me back here. I must have done something right the first time. I must have having them. So I thank you, Leon, for doing that. And I, too, want to join with Kelly in thanking both Leon and Sylvia. This is a remarkable event. What a fortunate opportunity is, not because the two of us are here, but because the people they've invited over the years, in 21 years, to come to this community and to speak to students. And I agree with Kelly totally. The idea of actually putting aside those 400 students today from various schools, including high school students in the area, was a wonderful way to reach out to students and give them an opportunity and chance to engage with it. So thank you for that immensely. The question you've asked is whether or not the American dream is alive and well. And obviously, there's some very legitimate questions. This isn't something you can wish for it happens. Each generation has had to make it happen. And the question we have to answer is whether or not we're doing the right things in terms of public policy at the local level, state, and national level. It's not just a Washington issue, but are we doing the right things to create the environment where these young people have the chance to take advantage of the opportunities that this nation, throughout its history, has provided each succeeding generation? I have a lot more confidence in the sense of the question of whether or not something may happen this time regarding, because of what Kelly just talked about, these young people, these high school students who didn't just go to memorial services and funerals, as painful as that was, but actually within hours of the events ended up in Tallahassee talking to legislators there and making a difference. Their first reception was they totally moved on to a separate issue, had no legislative ideas to move forward on. Within a matter of days, of course, they've come back and have changed laws that were unthinkable in Florida politics as a result of these young people showing up. So the question of whether or not there's a bright future, one can take some hope in the fact that these young people in this one state have already started to make a difference. And I suspect that young people across the country watching them are going to realize there is the ability to create change, if it's possible. I grew up, as Leon mentioned, politically in the state of Connecticut. And so gun violence is something we're more than have a passing familiarity. I was in Newtown, Connecticut, the night before Sandy Hook. Stopped for a cup of coffee in that town on the way home. And obviously the next day, the tragedy of infant babies being gunned down. And then, of course, we know earlier than that, Columbine in Denver, in Colorado. And, of course, in Las Vegas a few months ago. And now, of course, in Florida. The common denominator there is these high-powered rifles, the AR-15 or others like them, the magazines, which, of course, hold a vast amount of bullets in them. There are also shootings every day, unfortunately, around the country. But there's something unique and special about the power and ability to cause such a volume of violence as a result of our ability to provide the access to these weapons. I think Kelly's absolutely right. I think the mental health issues, I managed on the floor of the Senate the mental health parity bill It was written by Pete Domenici, Republican senator from New Mexico, and Paul Wellstone from Minnesota, who cared deeply about it, both of them personally affected by mental health issues. I think the more that we can do on education, helping police and so forth, all of those things are important. But I honestly believe, at least when it comes to this one weapon and this magazine, we ought to be able to get that out of the hands of people. I just don't accept the notion that this country, with all it has, can't do that again. So I would go a step further.
They're talking about a number of things, the bump stop, bump stock prohibition.
I'm for that too.
The background checks, the issue of whether to increase the age for those that have access to assault weapons. And also now the president's raised this issue of teachers being armed in the schools.
That I'm totally opposed to. That's insane.
Kelly, what? What's your sense, Kelly?
My
sense. I've said it's insane. Jump in.
You say that about all the Republicans.
No.
My sense of it is this. We ask a lot of our teachers. I don't think that we should be asking teachers to take on this responsibility. But I will tell you, if there were trained people in the schools, like school resource officers, who many schools have, that makes sense to me. We actually need to give our teachers help in what they do every day. And so this to me, as a mother and thinking about what we already ask our teachers to do, I wouldn't say it makes sense.
Okay, let's turn to the economy and what's going on. President Trump says the economy is doing great. He says that, and in fact, he's got, there's low unemployment, great stock market, little quivers these last few weeks, rising wages, tax cuts, deregulation. Others worry that we do have an exploding debt, the whole issue of rising inflation, rising interest rates, perhaps an overvalued market. A recent poll by NBC and Wall Street Journal says that 60% of the public still think we may be on the wrong track in terms of our economy. What's your view of the state of the American economy right now, Chris?
Well, I think, again, you've identified some of the very positive things that have happened. The lower unemployment rate, obviously, the stock market, which I always think got to be careful about making judgments about that being a reflection necessarily of whether or not the economy is in great shape, but obviously it's been very strong as well. People are optimistic. They're far more positive, generally speaking, than they have been in some time. Obviously, coming out of the recession 8 years ago was difficult. It's taken time to get our footing again. So if you're taking a snapshot, today you'd have to say things are certainly a lot better than they were a few years ago. And I think that's something we can hopefully all agree on. The more legitimate question in light of the question you've asked, and that is there a brighter future for younger people coming along? Then the question gets more difficult as to whether or not, over the coming years, whether or not these decisions we made are going to continue to provide the kind of benefits. I have great concerns about that. I think many do. A fellow by the name of Mr. Dudley, who heads the New York Fed, issued some statements and speeches recently talking about the long-term implications of this, particularly in debt areas. And this is the problem. We've just added $1.5 trillion worth of debt as a result of the tax cut. I happen to agree to the thought that we should be doing something to cut the corporate tax rate. That needed to be done, in my view, for a lot of reasons. And there are other aspects of the bill which I think are fairly positive. But I'm deeply worried when you add that plus the $1.5 trillion we've just added to the budget itself as expenditures. That's $3 trillion added to the debt. We've gone in 2001, only 17 years ago, debt represented about 54% of the gross domestic product of the country. In 2012, it jumped to about 63%. It's now in excess of 100% of the gross domestic product of the country, a lot of it due to the recession. But in light of these new additions, either because of lost revenues or added financial burdens to the country, the question you've asked about whether or not young people are going to be able to have a bright future is going to require investments. At the local, state, and national level, on education, on health care, on some sort of a reconfiguration of the social contract, dealing with entitlement programs. All of these things are going to need our attention. Infrastructure, you can add your list to it. How do you do that? How can local governments, state governments, or the national government working together do it if we so saddle the coming generation with a financial burden that our debt is going to grow, the interest payments are due, most of it being held outside the United States, particularly China, poses some very serious issues for us. So it was a tougher call. I respect those who voted for the tax cut bill because of the corporate tax rate reduction. I would have come out against it in the end, but a narrow call. I'm not going to say this is overwhelming at all, and I can respect people who made a different decision. But I honestly think it was one we put a sort of thought more about. In 96, the Congress spent almost 3 years fashioning the tax cut under Ronald Reagan, along with people in the Congress, Democrats and Republicans. It took them a while to get it right, and for 30 years served us pretty well. Changes were made. I hope we don't have to wait another 30 years to come back to this, particularly if Mr. Dudley and others are right. And in the short term, okay, but longer than that, some real financial problems for the country. And I think we'll look back and maybe regret it deeply.
Kelly.
Well, I think we've long needed to address the fact that our business tax rate, our corporate tax rate is uncompetitive. We had the highest in the developed world. We know that many of our companies were keeping money overseas. You know, look at what Apple's now bringing back, billions of dollars, essentially, with this tax bill and dropping the rate to 21%. So this was actually something that President Obama wanted to do, too, was to drop the corporate rate. So we needed to do it. So overall, I don't think that bill was perfect, but I am glad that we have made a more competitive business rate. And we've seen where companies have reacted to it, whether it's increasing wages or bonuses, and even in my home state of New Hampshire, small businesses who are giving some of the resources that they're getting from this tax bill back to their workforce. So, you know, for me, I think that that bill is something, as I've talked long about the fact that I hoped that we would have a more competitive business rate to keep investment here in the United States of America. That said, I think Chris has a really important point here. Under President Obama, we had trillion-dollar deficits, and we're about to go back in 2019 into trillion-dollar deficits under President Trump. It took two parties to get us in debt the way we are today, and it's going to take two parties to get us out. No party's hands are clean on this. And the combination of the tax bill, which I believe will drive economic growth, but with a $1.5 trillion and a $1.5 trillion by the bipartisan spending bill, that brings us back to trillion-dollar deficits. And we have to keep our eye on this, and we need to focus on it because, again, in the long term, the interest rates are going up. They're, as the economy, let's face it, the Federal Reserve was keeping them very low historically to try to deal with the economic crisis we were in. So we all knew they had to come up eventually, and we're a debtor. Just like we have a mortgage at home, the government's going to have to pay more interest too, and we will have less to spend on whether defending the nation or anything else, and it will be tough choices down the line if people don't act sooner rather than later on the debt and really keep an eye on this. Unfortunately, both parties need to do it, and both parties are guilty on this front.
Kelly, what's happened with the Republicans on this issue? They used to be the voice for fiscal responsibility. I think when I was chairman of the Budget Committee, the Republicans were always working with us to try to see if we could develop deficit reduction plans,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. It was very clear that that's where they were coming from. Now I get the impression that President Trump and the Republicans basically don't seem to care about the growing debt. What's gone on? What's happened?
Well, I think that if you care about the debt, you need to care about the debt even when there's a president of your party in office. And so I'm disappointed that, like, the recent budget spending bill, which did do important things like the defense issue, which you've been passionate about and I have because I've been worrying about the hollowing out of our military. But that said, it didn't seem like any of those strong voices other than Rand Paul in the middle of the night, who often I disagree with, but on this one, I think what he was saying in the middle of the night made some sense. Those voices are not there right now, and I think you're right to call the Republican Party out on this. And one thing that I'm worried about as we think about our debt, you know, that budget bill only covered a third of what we spend. Two-thirds of what we spend don't even go through the budget. That's mandatory spending, Medicare, Social Security, which are on the path to insolvency. And the issue really is if we don't get a hold of that, not only the insolvency of these programs, but we're going to continue to see, no matter what we do on that third, to see that we don't get a hold of the debt. And also, by the way, we put our social safety net in jeopardy if we don't act on those issues now. And unfortunately, President Trump ran under the mantra that he wouldn't touch anything. President Obama wouldn't touch anything there, right? So if neither party is willing to say, I'm going to look at two-thirds of how we spend the money, it's really hard to address the debt. And that is the issue, really, that we're facing. And it's going to take some political courage. I'm not saying it's easy. It's the third rail of politics. I get it. I've lived it. But that's the type of leadership that we really need if we're going to address the long-term fiscal state of this country.
Chris, let me ask you, because you and I were there when we actually developed budget agreements during Republican administrations and Democratic administrations. And those agreements that ultimately led to a balanced budget and a surplus were agreements that did deal with savings and entitlement programs. I remember going out to Andrews Air Force Base for a few weeks to try to develop an agreement. And the agreement we came up with was $250 billion in savings from entitlements, $250 billion in new taxes, and we also put caps on discretionary spending. If you're going to deal with the federal budget, if you're going to try to deal with a $1 trillion deficit, you've got to address each of those areas. I don't get a sense that Republicans or Democrats want to address any of those areas. How do we get to the point where we face this issue honestly?
Well, it sounds simplistic, but you got to start with political leadership. There was political leadership in those days. Whether you agreed or disagreed with Ronald Reagan or not, he wanted to be a leader on these issues. You had people like Dan Rostenkowski, chairing the Ways and Means Committee in the House of Representatives. You had Bob Dole, George Mitchell. You had other people who understood that they were there for limited periods of time. There was an opportunity to get together and resolve this. It took 3 years, by the way. This latest fiasco went through in a matter of days and hours in some cases with almost no hearings even on what we were going to do. I've never seen such mismanagement of an issue of that significance handled in such a cavalier way and fashion. Where was the leadership on this, other than some bumper sticker kind of approaches, talking about make America great again or something, and we all want to have that happen, but again, necessarily, I think it's still a great country, by the way. And so you ended up with a sloppy mess, in my view, and it didn't have the leadership to go through and work through those issues. It's not easy. They're important constituencies. I know, obviously, the entitlement programs, obviously, are an issue. But we've made a huge difference in the lives of people in this country. The poorest segment of our population were the elderly. Until we came along in the 1960s with Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security going back. They've been a lifesaver to people. And so, well, changes to them, I understand that and respect that. But let's not step back and suggest somehow that the next generation is going to have a better future somehow if we deprive people of that safety net. We need to do things like reconfigure the social contract. Kelly and I have talked about this already today. You have some 80 million Americans, close to that number, which are what I call gig employees, contingency employees, independent contracts, and the numbers are growing. We ought to have some sort of portability for these kind of benefits so that people can move jobs as they're doing. They're not going to be 30 years at the Aetna Insurance Company or Travelers in Connecticut or the United Technologies in my state. They're going to be looking for jobs that will change dramatically over their lifespan. So let me just take advantage of your question to say this much to you. I think people have not spent enough time with each other in Congress. They're overwhelmed today with fundraising, with all the other obligations. I'll tell you something I did the day I left the Senate. Kelly and I know the wonderful new senator from Republican Senate that was elected in 1980, the year that I left the Senate. And he came up to me on the floor of the Senate the day I was leaving, on January 3rd, 1981, and teasingly said to me, "What's your big advice? You've been here a while. I'm new. You're leaving. I'm staying. What do I do?" Well, the Senate chamber floor was packed that day because new people were being sworn in. And I turned to him and I said, "Look at the Democrats over here and pick out the 20 or 30 people you think are absolutely the antithesis of everything you believe in and care about. You're not going to have much to do in the minority for the first year or so. Take each one of them to lunch or dinner or breakfast, and three things will happen, I promise you. One, you're going to actually like them. I don't want to scare you, but you're actually going to like them. because you've actually followed a similar path to get here, different parties, but nonetheless very similar. Number two, and really going to frighten you now, you're going to agree with each other on far more than you have any idea. People don't understand that, but really, when people sit down and talk, they find out they agree on a lot more than they could imagine. If you do the first two, I said, then the third thing you'll do is work together. And that's what makes this job, one, personally interesting, but also you get something done. In my 30 years in the Senate, I never introduced a single piece of legislation, except one in the end, where I didn't have a Republican partner, not one. I didn't know what the point was of introducing it if I didn't have a partner to get it done with, in a sense. So you've got to understand why you're there and how this works and spend the time at it. People have strong views. They feel passionately about what they care about. In fact, I always found it easier to negotiate with someone who felt passionately about what they cared about, you know, in a sense. But it takes work. It doesn't happen in a cavalier fashion. And leadership has to step up. So it's not how do you fix the problem? How do you spend more time with each other? I don't know if the senator did what I suggested to him that day, and it maybe sounds simplistic to you. But if you don't know your colleagues, if you don't know their families, what they care about, what their hobbies are, how they spend their spare time, what are their views of the world beyond the bill on the floor that day? If all I know about you is what political party you belong to and what ideological group you're comfortable with, that's not much. If you spend time there, it used to be the federal government paid for one round-trip ticket when you got elected to Congress. It got you there, and at the end of the session, brought you home. There was none of this the federal government subsidizing travel every weekend back and forth to your district and state. People had to get to know each other. And as a result, when they worked together, they accomplished the great things, in my view. That's a formula, in my view, for victory.
Let me ask about going back to this question of the American dream. There was the hope in this country, obviously, that the great thing about America was building a middle class, and certainly coming out of World War II, that's what we did. We built a strong, very strong middle class in which families could enjoy the opportunity to really get ahead. There are now concerns about a middle class that is disappearing. A result of automation, globalization, lost jobs, what have you. We know that part of this, we know that jobs have gone overseas, but the bigger cost of jobs now is what's happening with technology.
Right.
Microchips, robotics, artificial intelligence, obviously are producing a lot of technology that now is taking jobs from people. We're likely to lose not only Uber drivers, but truck drivers, automobile makers. There's a lot of jobs that are on the line. How can we develop that strong middle class in terms of those jobs for the future if science keeps taking those jobs away? Kelly?
I think one of the things that we have at this point fallen down on is our education system. And that, as I look at our education system going to elementary school, I have kids that are 10 and 13, but we know that the technology is changing. We see disruption everywhere, and yet we're not, for example, teaching coding in schools, right? I mean, my son is interested in it, and I've had to go, get him to an extra elective kind of class outside the regular school area, right? And so not every parent can do that. But why should they have to? We really need to update our curriculum. We need to update at every level of our education system for the 21st century jobs, and we haven't done that. I think we need to update even how we use technology in the schools at the higher education level and throughout. And so we're behind on this. And we know artificial intelligence is barreling down. We know we're already losing jobs to technology. And I don't think that we're giving people the skills that they need. And it's not just the four-year college skills. It's career technical education. Even in my home state of New Hampshire, we have less than a 2% unemployment rate. And I can go around to manufacturers in my state. They're all looking for workforce. And they actually don't need someone who has a four-year degree, but they do need someone who has some basic technology skills. They do need someone who obviously making sure the basics are strengthened, you know, basic mathematics, basic communication, English, and they do need even trades, welding and other areas where there are gaps. And I don't think that we're really doing a service to our students of making sure that we're marrying up the skills with the jobs of today and the jobs of tomorrow. So I hope that's an area. We also invest in job training, for example, for dislocated workers in Washington, and those programs are antiquated. They need to be fully updated to where we are today. So there's an area, I think, that shouldn't be controversial, that I would hope we would see some bipartisanship around. There are some think tanks working on this. There are some senators on both sides of the aisle that are taking up the issue, but we really need to accelerate that effort and move as fast as we can, or we're going to be left behind, and we're going to see further gaps and further inequality as a result.
Chris, you had some numbers about... You were mentioning some numbers about the number of lost jobs we're likely to see.
Well, yeah, first I agree with what Kelly has just said. I mean, I mentioned earlier that sort of knowing the moment you're in is oftentimes one of the major problems of getting people to pay attention. You talked earlier, Leon, we were talking about whether or not you operate with leadership or crisis. And historically, we've been more of a crisis-oriented society. We wait for something to be sitting in our lap, and we generally have risen to the occasion, but we've been lucky in a sense. And this is an example here where I don't think we really understand the moment yet we're in. We have some sense of it, but don't deeply appreciate how fundamental the change is that's occurring in our country and in the world. It is, I talk about it, the only comparison I can make is an industrial revolution, where it was a radical change, moving from an agrarian-based economy to a very different one, where people moved from farms into cities. The transition was not as difficult to learn how to operate a sewing machine or in New York City or Connecticut someplace or New Hampshire. But today, obviously, moving from an economy that is basically a 20th century economy, a static economy for a good part of it, into this new world is going to be challenging beyond our imagination. And it isn't just jobs, it's everything. Politics are changing. The whole culture we live in is fundamentally being altered in ways that are hard to understand and grasp. But we need to get that. You can't even begin to talk about the things that Kelly has mentioned, that I support and others do as well, if you don't accept the fact that we need to be disruptive. We're looking at an educational system that basically was started about the same time as the Republic did. An agrarian calendar. We had four-year institutions in the 16th century in this country. We're still talking about you have to have 4 years in college. Why not two? Why can't you get a master's degree when you're 18 or 19 instead of having to wait until you finish 4 years of college? I mean, all sorts of things we ought to be thinking about differently to make sure education is affordable and accessible. And it needs to go beyond just thinking about higher education and secondary education, in a sense. And that is, of course, where we're, again, I would have preferred, for instance, in the tax bill that we incentivize businesses to have really significant on-the-job training. AT&T is doing this with 280,000 employees are voluntarily employee identifying themselves as people who need different training, in a sense, to come in and provide that for them. They're paying for it. They're seeing the advantage for them as a corporation. There are programs in Louisville, Kentucky, where they're providing free of charge to elementary school students and high school students exactly what Kelly is talking about. I have a daughter, my two children, I have a 13-year-old daughter and a 16-year-old daughter. My 16-year-old is in a good school in Washington, D.C. There are three students in her class on coding, three. Here, we had needed 7 million jobs last year alone in coding in this country, and the numbers are only growing. 5 million jobs will disappear in the next 12 years because of the driverless automobile. That's the estimate, at least 5 million. 15% of the global employment force today will be gone in the next 20 years. We may lose as many as 80 million jobs in the United States that exist today that will not exist in 20 years. And so this is a crisis of significant proportion. And education is going to be a critical component of that. But also we need to be developing alternative ideas. One area that deserves far more attention is in renewable sources of energy. Here's a great opportunity for us to put people to work, to make a significant contribution to our economic growth, and also to provide jobs for export and the like in solar, wind power, all the other various terms of energy you can think about. There are millions of jobs in that area alone. And we need to train people to do that. So the answers are out there. I mean, but we need to understand the moment we're in and how significant it is that's occurring. And if we don't wake up sooner, then the question you've asked at the outset of this gathering tonight, Leon, is going to have a dreadful answer to it. Because it won't be just what we wish we could do or what we've done historically. We will have failed. We will have failed. And there are other competitors around the globe today who are growing in strength and competency, who are going to defeat us, in effect, in providing these kind of jobs and technologies, which we ought to lead on. We ought not to be taking a backseat to anybody. We're leading in solar, in wind power today. But we could lose that leadership very quickly if we don't step up and respond. So these combination of things are absolutely critical. But I think energy, alternative energy, renewable energies offer some of the best hope for replacing the jobs we're going to lose.
We're at that point where I want to recognize the question review team, the people who select the questions that will be presented to the speakers in our second half here. I ask you to hold your applause until I introduce all of them, please. First, Fran Gaver, who's our veteran question review team member. Kara Myberg Guzman, who's managing editor of the Santa Cruz Sentinel. Dave Kellogg, managing editor of the Monterey Herald. Doug McKnight, who's a reporter from KAZU Radio. And Christian Ponce, who is a staff reporter of the Salinas Californian. Would you thank them for being here? And we have, as mentioned here, we have a group of students who are representing those who attended the afternoon student program. We had almost 400 at the program. It was a wonderful session with our speakers. What I'd like to do is to ask all of the students in attendance to stand and remain standing, if they would, until I identify all the schools that they're from. Would you please stand, all of the students in the audience? That's great. Thank you. Let me just mention the schools quickly. Cal Maritime Academy, CSU Monterey Bay, Defense Language Institute, Middlebury Institute, the Monterey High School, Monterey Peninsula College, Navy Postgraduate School, the Pacific Collegiate School, San Jose State, Santa Clara University, UC Santa Cruz, and York School. Thank you all for being here.
Now, and Leon, the fact that you've had to sit through this twice and listen to us today ought to be an automatic A in your class, whatever you are.
I also want to mention that the afternoon program is produced because of the generosity of the support that we get from our lecture series sponsors. And Sylvia and I and the Panetta Board Institute Board of Directors are very grateful for the sponsorships that allow these students from high schools, from colleges, from universities, from military installations to have the opportunity to participate with our speakers. If you would give our sponsors a hand, I would appreciate it.